You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
There is a place where time stands still, where nature is harsh and demanding, where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man.
I want my land.
Kick it in the guts, Barry.
Far away from my
home. All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test. Three simple questions, three correct answers,
did you get all this
and
together?
You go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
Hi, Annie here for Showreel, 3CR's look at what is happening in the Australian moving image industry. First up, a chat I had with Andrew from the Queer Screen Film Fest in Sydney. Andrew is the programming and industry manager for the festival, and they spoke to me about the emerging narrative feature film competition, which has a deadline of May the 24th.
Queer Screen Film Fest is coming into its 13th edition. It is a second festival that Queer Screen added every year, in addition to the Mardi Gras Film Festival, which has been running, coming up on its 33rd edition. Queer Screen Film Fest was founded as an opportunity to create more space to showcase more LGBTQI plus filmmaking. And this emerging narrative feature competition is something that me and the new CEO, Benson Wu, wanted to introduce to showcase and spotlight more emerging LGBTIQ plus filmmakers. I think it's a really great opportunity to showcase the amazing work that is coming from emerging filmmakers, which sometimes don't get the same attention within the film festival space. It's open to LGBTIQ plus directors who are presenting their first or second narrative feature film, and it's a juried competition with a cash prize.
Yeah, which is very nice, really. You focused on what filmmakers actually need. Part of this, it strikes me, is that you're seeding or building a community for filmmakers to actually hone their craft as well as to have a long career. That's right, isn't it?
Yes. I think it's really important. I think that's something that when Queer Screen was founded, it was founded by LGBTIQ plus filmmakers back in 1993, who wanted to make sure that there was a space not only to showcase queer filmmaking, but also to create a space where they could foster filmmaking going forward, which is part of why Queer Screen has always had many different initiatives to support the industry. Like since 1993, we've had the My Queer Career, which is Australia's richest LGBTIQ plus short film competition, which runs every single year. Over the years, we've had filmmakers like Sophie Hyde, Adam Elliott, Kate Shortland had short films in there, Goran Stalevsky, who have obviously gone on to have amazing careers since. It's one of my favorite nights of the festival every year, to just get all those short filmmakers together in the same room to celebrate their films and to form these relationships between them so they can then continue their careers. We also have Queer Screen's Completion Fund every year since 2016, where we offer funding to films which are in post-production so they can get that film over the line, because we know how difficult it can be to actually just get the film finished. And since 2016, we've awarded $172,000 worth of funding to that. And we also have, every single year, we have the LGBTIQ plus short film pitching competition called Pitch Off, where short filmmakers can pitch their film to a jury and audience, and the winner then receives $10,000 to go off and make that film. Since 2018, we've awarded $70,000 in funding, and 7 films have been made. It's one of the things that I'm really passionate about, and making sure that Queer Screen is helping foster the future of queer filmmaking and celebrating what's being made.
So the reaction from the queer filmmaking community obviously has been positive. Like they consider this to be a real springboard for their creative careers.
Absolutely. The thing I love about the pitching competition is obviously we have six finalists who pitch their films. One of them wins the prize, but every single year, after seeing those pitches, over the next couple of years, I get to see those films get created, even if they didn't get the funding, because they form these connections with each other. They are able to use the experience to build on what they're doing. And I've seen them produce each other's films because they've made connections by meeting each other through doing the competition. It's all about making sure that people actually can just get their foot in the door and get the films made.
The thing that's interesting, of course, is that mainstream stories have been considered to be the cultural output. But over time, what's happened is the queer community is saying quite clearly that we have other stories that need to be told and need to be in center state. Not that they're from another planet, but they're actually part of the same world that should be paid attention to. But there's obviously elements to a queer person's experience which is contributing in a really positive way to the mainstream.
I think absolutely. I think that there's an element of having a outsider view sometimes on elements of what's going on in the world, where even if you're not even telling a specifically LGBT story, that perspective is unique and something that I think has helped shape the culture in such a unique way. I think that's what I love about queer film festivals is getting to see all those different perspectives from around the world. And yes, there are some through lines, some shared elements, like coming out, dealing with prejudice that carries through so many of the films. But so many of the films are just unique and wonderful and celebratory and weird. And that's what I love about queer film. It's just a really great space where everything is celebrated, and you can have those coming out stories, but you can also have weird and wonderful horror films and the greatest genre expanding things. It's a really great space.
That's what I was thinking, because as time goes on, what you're going to have is because there's a lot of pushback against prejudice, and I'm allowed to have space, and really important coming of age films, which every person, whatever their background, needs to voice. But I was thinking that the actual giving space to emerging filmmakers is, and over time, what you're going to do is have this complexity of filmmaking that's in going to add to comedy, is going to add to horror, as you say, is going to add to all these different, I mean, there's a, animation, all these different elements, but it's going to become less self-conscious, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that's the thing of you constantly see people who, now that there's definitely been an expansion in representation and availability of people being able to see queer stories, that the filmmakers who are coming through have grown up seeing those queer stories. So it's not like they haven't seen themselves, they just haven't seen themselves in the most authentic way. So they're basically seeing, oh, gay people exist, or queer people, or trans people exist on screen, but that's not how I see that. So what is the way that I can make that more authentic? And it creates this extra layers of authenticity and depth and, as you said, humor or interesting ways of telling those stories, which I think is really wonderful that we're seeing people get more experimental, get more in depth with the way they explore the different themes.
The deadline for entries come up on the 24th of May. Tell me about the process that somebody has to take in order to get their film entered.
Yes, you can just head to Film Freeway and go to Queer Screen Film Fest's page, and you just submit your film through there. You select the category and fill in a few different questions about your film and who you are.
All right,
It's
so there's
been
not.
very straightforward.
Yeah, that's right. The hard part is actually making the film.
Exactly.
All right, thanks very much for talking to me, Andrew.
Thank you so much.
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're back with Annie on Showreel on 3CR, your community radio station. We're now going to a chat I had with David Field and Stephen DuPont about their film The Half-Barbaric Twang. Field is a very well-known character actor, but less well-known is that he's a musician. In this delightful road movie around the back streets of rural New South Wales, Field is joined by fellow members of the Number 4 band, actor Jeff Morrell and well-known musician and producer Tim Oxley, as they tool around on the Gimme Back Me Dog tour, which is shot by well-known war photographer, filmmaker Stephen DuPont. The film debuted at the recent Gold Coast Film Festival. Watch out for it on streamers. The album is out now.
It's quite clearly an ode to being human. It is, isn't it?
That's actually, you know what? I've never put it that way. But I think it's very much about that. Also because of the way that this band has operated, because we've been outside the system. And, you know, the way that we play is that we walk into a pub, we put a hat down, and it's real old troubadour style. So I guess, yeah, that very much relates to it, you know. So it's a very old-fashioned but very, yeah, warm and humane way to deal with music, rather than, you know, as we both know, you know, with the acting world and all the rest of it, there's this distance, you know. And, yeah, so that's a beautiful way of putting it, though, Annie.
The whole business about you guys being, a couple of you being really well-known actors, and also Tim being a really well-known musician. Tell me about you guys being so musical. You're so musical.
Look, I've been playing since I was a kid, but I never sort of played outside the bedroom until I met Tim. And then I was doing a lot of traveling, a lot of working, and then I didn't want to carry a big instrument around with me anymore, so I bought a mandolin, and then things just kind of escalated from there, and then we started playing a lot more, and then writing, and then hadn't seen Jeff for years, and did a job with him, and he had a banjo with him. I was like, "What are you doing, banjo?" Yeah, all that story, and then we just played a lot, didn't we, Steve? I mean, we played daily.
Yep.
You know, every day we were playing. So, yeah, I guess we just slowly became, you know, slightly better at our musicianship. And Tim was always pretty strict with us too. You know, Tim's a real feel person, but he's with, when it comes to the music and when it comes to recording and things like that, he's very, very specific. So he kind of probably pushed us a lot with our musicianship, I would say, is a fair thing to say.
Well, you decided to go on this journey, and Stephen, I looked at some of your photos because you're known as a war photographer, but you're actually a person photographer, really, it appeared to me. This is what this film's about, isn't it, too, the way you shoot it. How much shooting did you do? Because, one, you really take us into the landscape, but you also do this wonderful thing. You do a whole lot of interviews in the car. You're on the move and you do interviews in the car. But how much shooting did you do?
Oh, I can't remember the exact, figures of hours, but quite a lot. I tend to shoot more than I need because I'm filming in a way that is observational. So it requires You know, a lot of the film footage is just unusable at times, but it requires to keep the camera rolling and wait for the moments, wait for the right words to come out of, you know, David or Tim or Jeff, and really just be rolling. It's very much a kind of fly on the wall approach. It's, you know, trying to capture that rawness and that reality and the spontaneity of these incredible characters, which, you know, the three of them are. I mean, my approach to the film was very much in that classic, you know, observational approach, and without interfering, you know, I really wanted to wait. And so there's a lot of filming involved. There's a lot of time, and it's very much just, you know, like I said, waiting for those moments. And I, you know, really wanted to capture the, you know, you mentioned the landscape, which I think is really important as an Australian. You can't not, you know, fall for the landscape, especially when you're touring out in country New South Wales. We're all blown away by the change of landscapes. And I think it fits in beautifully with the Number Four Band's music as well. It's about landscape. It's about country. It's about people. It's about love and passion. And I, you know, I was, you know, it was instrumental for me to try and capture all of that. So it's really about not just the landscape, but the human condition, really capturing each of their personalities as best as I could. You know, it was lucky because we were friends, you know, all of us are good friends. And we built up this incredible friendship during the filming of the film, and it was such an incredible pleasure for me, and not difficult. You know, we just had fun, and I was hoping that fun would come out in the actual end result of the film.
David, you make note of moving away from the seaboard and going deliberately into what you call the bush. Here these people are being served up great music, and they are so used to actually being quite quiet in a way.
Yes.
So it's a very interesting expansion of their character, isn't it? This yeah. meeting of the two worlds.
Well, I grew up in Western New South Wales, so I mean, the storytellers live there. That's where our storytellers always have. I mean, there's great storytellers in the city, but bush people don't have the distractions. So all they have is story and lies, you know, great lies, you know. And I grew up with, you know, uncles and mentors who were just great liars, you know, just great bullshit artists. And when Steve and I were cutting it, and, you know, and then people started looking at it. What's really surprising to me was the way that people said, oh, the music's just, how taken people were with the music. I kept saying to Steve, I'm a bit astounded by that, because I really thought the heart of the film was, in many ways, just those bush people, you know, and the kind of where we were and, you know, and our stupidity and all that kind of stuff. But people really leveled in with the music, which was just fantastic. And I think the mix, see, here's the thing that we really want to do, was we want to go to the country. Country people are forgotten, as we know, in this country. They're forgotten. And city people can say that they're not, but they are. And they know they are. They're not stupid. And I think there's always been a little bit of a look down attitude about country people. And so, because the three of us have spent so much time in the bush, all three of us, and Stephen spent so much time in the bush, I think there's a respect that Stephen gives these people through the camera that I think is really evident. And I think that's really heartwarming for an audience, and especially for a city audience, to kind of go, these people are kind of one-toothed, you know, red nose, you know, like you've got all these characters.
The people with the hats.
Exactly. But the heart, you know, and when they speak, they mean something. And that's incredibly endearing. And Steve sort of got that. And I think that's the other quality of Steve. And, of course, because he's been spent so much time in war, not just with a still camera, but with a film camera as well. You know, he's been everywhere through every war, that he's so good at being a fly on the wall, having to quietly be there and capture things. And I think that's probably a great part of the style of the way he shot it as well. We don't see ourselves as actors when we're doing this with Steve, you know. We just see ourselves as journeymen. And so we wanted to remain vulnerable, not be kind of seen as actors. We're not acting, you know. Our personalities are what's kind of come through, you know. You know, the sort of the star man, the rock man, and the, you know, village idiot, you know.
So tell me about the music, because it is actually really well produced in this film. I mean, it's really, really tasty. And also the other thing that struck me is that there are a whole lot of different environments, sound environments, acoustically. Like you go to the, you don't actually hide that, which is really great. You know, like that bit where you're out the back in a concrete with tin around you. You're in different pubs, which is, some of them are echoey. You go into the old church. There's a whole range of different acoustic environments that you're dealing with. But also, I was blown away by the fact that every song in the film is actually original. But in actual fact, when you're lying on the beds and you're tinkering with the songs and you make songs up, you're telling people they can do it too.
Yeah.
It's very punk.
Yeah. I guess it's that, it's a great look at, you know, it's one of the things that Tim and I used to just sit around and do all the time. You know, if we had a dinner party and there was 10 or 12 people, well, we'd make up a song about someone around the table, you know, and that would, you know, elevate into somebody else's song. And it's just something that we've always done as kind of, you know, storytellers. But yeah, now that is a great quality, and we forget that, you know. And we didn't, we, you know, Steve, like I sort of forget it all the time that people might like the music, or that these original songs might have some traction in terms of people liking them. We just get so much joy in what we're doing, we forget about the response, I guess. You know, you hope people like it, but everywhere we play, people love the songs. So we thought, well, we'll just keep doing our songs. Why should we do covers? And why should any musician? I mean, if I see a musician in a pub playing and they're singing, I don't know, forget a Chisel song or whatever, I'll go up and give them $50 and I'll say to them, listen, no one in this pub is actually fucking listening, right? You sing three of your own songs. I'll give you $50, you know, and you see their face light up and go, fantastic. You think, yeah, you're a musician, you know, play your songs. Why not? This is, should kind of be what music's about. We're so obsessed with this, you know, a 3 minute, 10 second, 120 beats per minute. Everything's been so raped. You know, if one goes back to the 70s and you look at, you know, Van Morrison or Neil Young or any one of those classic, Joni Mitchell, I mean, 6-7 minute song was nothing. And it held. It held beautifully. So we kind of, we're a little bit rebellious about that too. We're like, we really don't care what the industry does. We're just going to keep playing music the way we want to play music. And also, Stephen's been around us a lot. Like, Stephen and I have been mates for a long time. So also, we've had a lot of, you know, sitting around having dinner parties with, you know, Steve and his family and my family and Tim's family. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time together. So Stephen knew our music really, really well.
So how did you get it to sound so good, Stephen? Tell me.
The sound really was, honestly, it was fairly basic because it was just recorded straight from the camera. I think it had a lot to do with just capturing natural sound, as opposed, you know, trying to capturing the rawness of the environment that we were in, whether it's a pub or on the street, and so, you know, I'm shooting and I'm also controlling the sound. I think I got used to doing that under pressure when I made my first film in Papua New Guinea about rugby league and sort of violence and life inside a Port Moresby settlement. And I was, again, a one-man band, and learned to operate in very hard conditions, in very, very fast-moving kind of environment. And so, you know, you once you've kind of developed that style, and again, I like to just roll camera and almost look at what I'm seeing as a photograph, and not a movie or not a, you know, a moving picture, you know, and allow things to come in and out of frame. So I tend to just sit there and wait, and I'm just mastering the sound as best as I can. I mean, you know, I have to say, Spectrum, who who came on board, just incredible sound engineers. They took it to another level, which is amazing. So we're so grateful for everything that they provided, not just the sound, but the picture quality as well. You know, again, it just, for me, comes down to just feeling it and not trying to be gimmicky or not trying to do anything special, but just to be there and be up close and feel it. And hopefully, you know, everything comes out. You know, it's all cross your fingers and hope it all works.
Just as an aside, what is the camera you use?
It was a Canon C300, nothing special. It's not the gear. It's actually the artist behind the gear. It's always the author. It's always the person shooting. You know, I could have been shooting on a high 8 camera or, you know, something, you know, really cheap and nasty, and I think I still could have come up with some pretty interesting results.
Tell me about the edit. So you both did it together?
Yeah. I mean, I did an initial edit. I think it was about 16 hours. I can't remember exactly, but it was kind of a Ken Burns, you know, and I thought that was pretty good. And then Dave came on board, and then we chopped and chopped and chopped. And so we collaborated very closely on the edit. You know, so, you know, I take credit for the edit, but I would never have been able to do it without Fieldsy, without Dave being there. So we really did collaborate on this closely and really worked. And, you know, obviously got feedback from Tim and Jeff as well. But essentially, you know, we made those decisions together. And when you're so close to something, it's hard to, you know, I would have gone away with a 16-hour film and been really happy, because I would have just wanted every single song to play out in real time.
I think it was about 3.5 hours when Steve and I actually got together. It was down to about 3.5 hours. And we just looked at each other and said, it was about 3.5, I remember, Stephen. I just thought, this is great, but Kenna, they're just going to kill us out in the you know, 30-second viewing world. So we just got brutal. We said, okay, let's get brutal. And then once we got brutal, it found just a different rhythm. Also think there's enough, because there's the real sound, obviously, and then there's the recorded sound, which they're all Tim's mastering. That's all Tim's producing from the album. And I think it's inviting enough to make you go, oh, well, I wouldn't mind hearing that one, you know. So hopefully there's enough there. I know exactly what Steve means, because some of those jams we did, you just kind of want to keep them, like, yes, plucked through, because they were so good. But, you know, I think there's enough there for an audience to go, gee, I wouldn't mind kind of hearing this album, you know. So, you know, we shall see.
That's it for Showreel. Up next is Published or Not, and we'll go out with the number 4 band, Closer.
I'm gonna get closer to the ground. I'm gonna lie real still without a sound. I'm gonna put my head down in the fading light. The movement of the small beasts as they prepare for the night. I'm gonna get my heartbeat down real low, so it's beating as the world turns and I stand slow. Keep my mouth shut, got nothing to say. There's too much talking.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.